Hello, and welcome to Forgotten Fairy Tales. I'm your reader, Mara Hampson. You may have heard of Sleeping Beauty, or Beauty and the Beast, but there are tales, some darker, some stranger, which you may not have heard of until this very moment. Tonight, I'm going to read you part two of The Light Princess by George MacDonald. This is a multi-part story, so if you haven't listened to the first part, you might want to go back and listen to the previous episode first. Chapter 6. She laughs too much. Meantime, notwithstanding awkward occurrences and griefs that she brought upon her parents, the little princess laughed and grew, not fat, but plump and tall. She reached the age of 17 without having fallen into any worse scrape than a chimney, by rescuing her from which a little bird-nesting urchin got fame and a black face. Nor, thoughtless as she was, had she committed anything worse than laughter at everybody and everything that came in her way. When she was told, for the sake of experiment, that General Clanrunfor was cut to pieces with all his troops, she laughed. When she heard that the enemy was on his way to besiege her papa's capital, she laughed hugely. But when she was told that the city would certainly be abandoned to the mercy of the enemy's soldiery, why, then she laughed immoderately. She never could be brought to see the serious side of anything. When her mother cried, she said, "What queer faces Mama makes, and she squeezes water out of her cheeks! Funny Mama!" And when her papa stormed at her, she laughed and danced round and round him, clapping her hands and crying, "Do it again, papa! Do it again! It's such fun! Dear, funny papa!" And if he tried to catch her, she glided from him in an instant, not in the least afraid of him, but thinking it was part of a game not to be caught. With one push of her foot, she would be floating in the air above his head, or she would go dancing backwards and forwards and sideways like a great butterfly. It happened several times, when her mother and father were holding a consultation about her in private, that they were interrupted by vainly repressed outbursts of laughter over their heads, and, looking up with indignation, saw her floating at full length in the air above them, whence she regarded them with the most comical appreciation of the position. One day an awkward accident happened. The princess had come out upon the lawn with one of her attendants, who held her by the hand. Spying her father at the other side of the lawn, she snatched her hand from the maid's and sped across to him. Now, when she wanted to run alone, her custom was to catch up a stone in each hand, so that she might come down again after a bound. Whatever she wore as part of her attire had no effect in this way. Even gold, when it thus became, as it were, a part of herself, lost all its weight for the time. But whatever she held only in her hands retained its downward tendency. On this occasion, she could see nothing to catch up but a huge toad that was walking across the lawn as if he had 100 years to do it in, not knowing what disgust meant, for this was one of her peculiarities. She snatched up the toad and bounded away. She had almost reached her father, and he was holding out his arms to receive her and take from her lips the kiss which hovered on them like a butterfly on a rosebud, when a puff of wind blew her aside into the arms of a young page who had just been receiving a message from His Majesty. Now, it was no great peculiarity in the princess that, once she was set a-going, it always cost her time and trouble to check herself. On this occasion, there was no time. She must kiss, and she kissed the page. She did not mind it much, for she had no shyness in her composition, and she knew, besides, that she could not help it. So she only laughed like a musical box. The poor page fared the worst. For the princess, trying to correct the unfortunate tendency of the kiss, put out her hands to keep off the page, so that, along with the kiss, he received, on the other cheek, a slap with the huge black toad, which she poked right in his eye. He tried to laugh, too, but the attempt resulted in such an odd contortion of countenance as showed that there was no danger of his pluming himself on the kiss. As for the king, his dignity was greatly hurt, and he did not speak to the page for a whole month. I may here remark that it was very amusing to see her run, if her mode of progression could properly be called running, for first she would make a bound, then, having alighted, she would run a few steps, and make another bound. Sometimes she would fancy she had reached the ground before she actually had, and her feet would go backwards and forwards, running upon nothing at all, like those of a chicken on its back. Then she would laugh like the very spirit of fun, only in her laugh there was something missing. What it was, I find myself unable to describe. I think it was a certain tone, depending upon the possibility of sorrow. Morbidezza, perhaps. She never smiled. Chapter 7. Try Metaphysics. After a long avoidance of the painful subject, the king and queen resolved to hold a council of three upon it, so they sent for the princess. In she came, sliding and flitting and gliding from one piece of furniture to another, and put herself at last in an armchair, in a sitting posture. Whether she could be said to sit, seeing she received no support from the seat of the chair, I do not pretend to determine. "My dear child," said the king, "you must be aware by this time that you are not exactly like other people."
"Oh, you dear funny papa, I have got a nose and two eyes and all the rest. So have you, so has mamma."
"Now be serious, my dear, for once," said the queen.
"No, thank you, mamma, I had rather not."
"Would you not like to be able to walk like other people?" said the king.
"No, indeed, I should think not. You only crawl. You are such slow coaches."
"How do you feel, my child?" he resumed, after a pause of discomfiture.
"Quite well, thank you."
"I mean, what do you feel like?"
"Like nothing at all that I know of."
"You must feel like something."
"I feel like a princess, with such a funny papa, and such a dear pet of a queen mamma."
"Now really," began the queen, but the princess interrupted her.
"Oh yes," she added, "I remember. I have a curious feeling sometimes, as if I were the only person that had any sense in the whole world."
She had been trying to behave herself with dignity, but now she burst into a violent fit of laughter, threw herself backwards over the chair, and went rolling about the floor in an ecstasy of enjoyment. The king picked her up easier than one does a down quilt, and replaced her in her former relation to the chair. The exact preposition expressing this relation I do not happen to know.
"Is there nothing you wish for?" resumed the king, who had learned by this time that it was useless to be angry with her.
"Oh, you dear papa, yes,"
answered she.
"What is it, my darling?"
"I have been longing for it for, oh, such a time, ever since last night."
"Tell me what it is."
"Will you promise to let me have it?"
The king was on the point of saying yes, but the wiser queen checked him with a single motion of her hand.
"Tell me what it is, first," said he.
"No, no, promise first."
"I dare not. What is it?"
"Mind, I hold you to your promise. It is to be tied to the end of a string, a very long string indeed, and to be flown like a kite. Oh, such fun! I would rain rose water, and hail sugar plums, and snow whipped cream, and
A fit of laughter checked her, and she would have been off again over the floor had not the king started up and caught her just in time. Seeing nothing but talk could be got out of her, he rang the bell and sent her away with two of her ladies in waiting.
"Now, queen," he said, turning to Her Majesty, "what is to be done?"
"There is but one thing left, answered she. "Let us consult the College of Metaphysicians."
"Bravo!" cried the king. "We will."
Now, at the head of this college were two very wise philosophers, by the name of Humdrum and Copy Keck. For them the king sent, and straightway they came. In a long speech he communicated to them what they knew very well already, as who did not, namely, the peculiar condition of his daughter in relation to the globe on which she dwelt, and requested them to consult together as to what might be the cause and probable cure of her infirmity. The king laid stress upon the word, but failed to discover his own pun. The queen laughed, but Humdrum and Copy Keck heard with humility and retired in silence. The consultation consisted chiefly in propounding and supporting, for the thousandth time, each his favorite theories, for the condition of the princess afforded delightful scope for the discussion of every question arising from the division of thought, in fact, of all the metaphysics of the empire. But it is only justice to say that they did not altogether neglect the discussion of the practical question, what was to be done. Humdrum was a materialist, and Copy Keck was a spiritualist. The former was slow and sententious, the latter was quick and flighty. The latter generally had the first word, the former the last. "I reassert my former assertion," began Copy Keck with a plunge. "There is not a fault in the princess, or body, or soul, only they are wrong put together. Listen to me now, Humdrum, and I will tell you in brief what I think. Don't speak, don't answer me, I won't hear you until I have done. At that decisive moment, when souls seek their appointed habitations, two eager souls met, struck, rebounded, lost their way, and arrived each in the wrong place. The soul of the princess was one of those, and she went far astray. She does not belong by rights to this world at all, but to some other planet, probably Mercury. Her proclivity to her true sphere destroys all the natural influence which this orb would otherwise possess over her corporeal frame. She cares for nothing here. There is no relation between her and this world. She must, therefore, be taught, by the sternest compulsion, to take an interest in the earth as the earth. She must study every department of its history, its animal history, its vegetable history, its mineral history, its social history, its moral history, its political history, its scientific history, its literary history, its musical history, its artistical history, above all, its metaphysical history. She must begin with the Chinese dynasty and end with Japan, but first of all she must study geology, and especially the history of the extinct races of animals, their natures, their habits, their loves, their hates, their revenges. She must—"
"Hold, hold!" roared Humdrum. "It is certainly my turn now. My rooted and insubvertible conviction is that the causes of the anomalies evident in the princess's condition are strictly and solely physical. But that is only tantamount to acknowledging that they exist. Hear my opinion. From some cause or other of no importance to our inquiry, the motion of her heart has been reversed. That remarkable combination of suction and force pump works the wrong way. I mean, in the case of the unfortunate princess, it draws in where it should force out, and forces out where it should draw in. The offices of the auricles and the ventricles are subverted. The blood is sent forth by the veins and returns by the arteries. Consequently, it is running the wrong way through all her corporeal organism, lungs and all. Is it then at all mysterious, seeing that such is the case, that on the other particular of gravitation, as well, she should differ from normal humanity? My proposal for the cure is this. Phlebotomize until she is reduced to the last point of safety. Let it be effected, if necessary, in a warm bath.
When she is reduced to a state of perfect asphyxie, apply a ligature to the left ankle, drawing it as tight as the bone will bear. Apply, at the same moment, another of equal tension around the right wrist. By means of plates constructed for the purpose, place the other foot and hand under the receivers of two air pumps. Exhaust the receivers, exhibit a pint of French brandy, and await the result.
"Which would presently arrive in the form of grim death," said Copycack.
"If it should, she should yet die in doing our duty," retorted Humdrum.
But their majesties had too much tenderness for their volatile offspring to subject her to either of the schemes of the equally unscrupulous philosophers. Indeed, the most complete knowledge of the laws of nature would have been unserviceable in her case, for it was impossible to classify her. She was a fifth imponderable body, sharing all the other properties of the ponderable.
Chapter 8. Try a drop of water. Perhaps the best thing for the princess would have been to fall in love. But how a princess who had no gravity could fall into anything is a difficulty, perhaps the difficulty. As for her own feelings on the subject, she did not even know that there was such a beehive of honey and stings to be fallen into. But now I come to mention another curious fact about her. The palace was built on the shores of the loveliest lake in the world, and the princess loved this lake more than father or mother. The root of this preference, no doubt, although the princess did not recognize it as such, was that the moment she got into it, she recovered the natural right of which she had been so wickedly deprived, namely, gravity. Whether this was owing to the fact that the water had been employed as the means of conveying the injury, I do not know. But it is certain that she could swim and dive like the duck her old nurse said she was. The manner in which this alleviation of her misfortune was discovered was as follows. One summer evening, during the carnival of the country, she had been taken upon the lake by the king and queen in the royal barge. They were accompanied by many of the courtiers in a fleet of little boats. In the middle of the lake, she wanted to get into the Lord Chancellor's barge, for his daughter, who was a great favorite with her, was in it with her father. Now, the old king rarely condescended to make light of his misfortune, yet, happening on this occasion to be in a particularly good humor, as the barges approached each other, he caught up the princess to throw her into the chancellor's barge. He lost his balance, however, and, dropping into the bottom of the barge, he lost hold of his daughter, not, however, before imparting to her the downward tendency of his own person, though in a somewhat different direction. For as the king fell into the boat, she fell into the water. With a burst of delighted laughter, she disappeared into the lake. A cry of horror ascended from the boats. They had never seen the princess go down before. Half of the men were under the water in a moment, but they had all, one after another, come up to the surface again for breath when, tinkle, tinkle, babble, and gush, came the princess's laugh over the water far away. There she was, swimming like a swan. Nor would she come out for king or queen, chancellor or daughter. She was perfectly obstinate. But at the same time, she seemed more sedate than usual. Perhaps it was because a great pleasure spoils laughing. At all events, after this, the passion of her life was to get into the water, and she was always the better behaved, and the more beautiful the more she had of it. Summer and winter it was quite the same, only she could not stay so long in the winter when they had to break the ice to let her in. Any day, from morning till evening in summer, she might be descried a streak of white in the blue water, lying as still as the shadow of a cloud, or shooting along like a dolphin, disappearing and coming up again far off, just where one did not expect her. She would have been in the lake of a night, too, if she could have had her way, for the balcony of her window overhung a deep pool in it, and through a shallow, reedy passage she could have swum out into the wide, wet water, and no one would have been any the wiser. Indeed, when she happened to wake in the moonlight, she could hardly resist the temptation. But there was the sad difficulty of getting into it. She had as great a dread of the air as some children have of the water, for the slightest gust of wind would blow her away, and a gust might arise in the stillest moment. And if she gave her a push toward the water and just failed of reaching it, her situation would be dreadfully awkward, irrespective of the wind, for at best there she would have to remain, suspended in her nightgown, till she was seen and angled for by someone from the window.
"Oh, if I had my gravity," thought she, contemplating the water, "I would flash off this balcony like a long white sea-bird, headlong into the darling wetness. Hey-ho!"
This was the only consideration that made her wish to be like other people. Another reason for her being fond of the water was that in it alone she enjoyed any freedom, for she could not walk out without a cortege, consisting in part of a troop of light horse, for fear of the liberties which the wind might take with her. And the king grew more apprehensive with increasing years, till at last he would not allow her to take a walk abroad at all without some 20 silken cords fastened to as many parts of her dress and held by 20 noblemen. Of course, horseback was out of the question. But she bade goodbye to all this ceremony when she got into the water. And so remarkable were its effects upon her, especially in restoring her for the time to the ordinary human gravity, that Humdrum and Kabi Kek agreed in recommending the king to bury her alive for 3 years, in the hope that, as the water did her so much good, the earth would do her yet more. But the king had some vulgar prejudices against this experiment, and would not give his consent. Foiled in this, they yet agreed in another recommendation, which, seeing that one imported his opinions from China and the other from Tibet, was very remarkable indeed. They argued that, if water of external origin and application could be so efficacious, water from a deeper source might work a perfect cure. In short, that if the poor afflicted princess could by any means be made to cry, she might recover her lost gravity. But how was this to be brought about? Therein lay all the difficulty, to meet which the philosophers were not wise enough. To make the princess cry was as impossible as to make her way. They sent for a professional beggar, commanded him to prepare his most touching oracle of woe, helped him out of the court charade box to whatever he wanted for dressing up, and promised great rewards in the event of his success. But it was all in vain. She listened to the mendicant artist's story and gazed at his marvelous makeup till she could contain herself no longer, and went into the most undignified contortions for relief, shrieking, positively screeching with laughter. When she had a little recovered herself, she ordered her attendants to drive him away and not give him a single copper, whereupon his look of mortified discomfiture wrought his punishment and his revenge, for it sent her into violent hysterics from which she was with difficulty recovered. But so anxious was the king that the suggestion should have a fair trial, that he put himself into a rage one day, and, rushing up to her room, gave her an awful whipping. Yet not a tear would flow. She looked grave, and her laughing sounded uncommonly like screaming. But that was all. The good old tyrant, though he put on his best gold spectacles to look, could not discover the smallest cloud in the serene blue of her eyes. The end for now. Thank you for listening. And I hope you'll join me next week to hear what happens next to the poor princess. Will someone find a cure for her infirmity? If you enjoyed this story, or any of the other tales I've read to you, please consider subscribing or leaving a review on iTunes. The more reviews we get, the easier it will be for others to find this podcast. Thank you again, and have a good one.